budding genius. Well, we're going to see more evidence tonight that he was, in fact, an unusually gifted man. He was a genius. In fact, I'm going to show you a few slides tonight that just kind of blow me away every time I read them myself. And yet, that really never makes the difference. That is, we all have gifts, we all have abilities, we all have talents, and none of us are responsible for any of those things. I mean, we're accountable for them. We should develop them. We should work at them. But in fact, God gives them, and it's his decision. And yet, Paul wrote to the Corinthians and says, you come behind in no gift, but you Corinthians think because you have all these gifts, you're somebody, you reign. And Paul says the sign of apostolic ministry is suffering. It's service. It's weakness. And the most important thing about the plotting genius is that he kept plotting. And that's the theme that we are pursuing. When we left Brother Carey last night, he had lost a daughter, Anne, at the age of 2. His son Felix was 14. Felix's mom had been pretty much insane for the last 5 years, and Felix was turning into a really rough kid. That is, he was kind of a terror. And his younger brother, William, was just about as bad. He was learning from Felix. Jabez was now 7. He's the one who had been born literally weeks before they set sail. They had lost Lucy at just a few months old. Peter died at 5, just months before his brother Jonathan was born. So William now has 4 young sons, 2 teens, 2 preteens. He has a wife who is no help whatsoever. In fact, she is a debilitation for him. Since arriving in India, they have moved 4 times. This latest move, early 1799, is because the thriving indigo plantation where he had worked for the previous 3 or 4 years has just been destroyed by a monsoon. So he takes his life savings, basically all he had, and he sinks it into a farmstead in Kidderpur. He builds a house there, he sets his family there, and within weeks has a church up and running with nationals in the area and his family, and he's pouring himself into it. But honestly, he's been preaching to Hindus for 7 years, and not a single Hindu has gotten saved. His one associate, John Fountain, arrives at age 30 and is dead at age 33. He actually dies right about the time Carey moves to Kidderpur. But God was not silent, because just then, the BMS got a whole bunch of candidates to go to India and help Carey. God raised them up. They were William Ward. I mentioned him last night because on his way out, Carey had met Ward at a London church and found out that this young 20-something was a printer and a preacher, and Carey really liked that combination. And he said, you need to come over and print the scriptures I'm going to be translating soon. And 6 years later, Ward got on a ship to sail to India. Miss Tidd got on that ship because she knew John Fountain, and when he had sailed away 3 years before, she said, I'll come soon and we'll marry there. They were engaged. She didn't know until she arrived in Calcutta that he had died just weeks before. Mr. and Mrs. Daniel Brunston got on that ship to sail over, as well as Mr. and Mrs. William Grant and their 2 kids, Joshua and Hannah Marshman, and their 3 kids. That's a pretty good team. They set sail in May of 1799, and you know it's going to take 4 or 5 months to get there. They got there, and they asked the British government if they could settle in Kidderpur. Kidderpur was in British East India Company territory, but the British East India Company wasn't too worried about Carey. They may have been aware that every day he went out and preached to hordes of Hindus, but none of them were attending his church, and none of them were getting saved. And he was farming land, and he'd worked as an indigo plantation manager. And they kind of thought, well, you know, Carey's just a civilian. But this pack of people are obviously missionaries. And when they applied to settle in Kidderpur, the British said, not on your life. We're not going to allow you here. And here, God did something rather remarkable. Well, God does often things remarkable, but this is a key point in the story. The king of Denmark, some years before, the king of Denmark, who was a Lutheran, somewhat nominal Lutheran, had purchased a tract of land right across the Hooghly River from Serampore and established a Danish colony there. Now, it got swallowed up by the British a few decades later, but during this little stretch, there was a little Danish colony. And somehow, remember, Cary had originally gone over in a Danish ship. The governor of this Danish colony found out that these missionaries, these Baptists, needed a place to land. Now, Lutherans and Baptists, oil, water, you know, it's not really a perfect combination. Lutherans have never been real positive about these Baptists who hate infant baptism and stress personal conversion. And this governor's heart was strangely warmed, and he invited all of these Baptists to come to Serampore. And they did. Ward traveled over to Kidderpore and said, "Brother Cary, we're here. We're at Serampore. You want to join us?" Cary had given up all his money to settle in Kidderpore. He had a church already up and running. It seemed like wherever he went, churches sprang up. He had moved 4 times over the previous 7 years. And this was right across the river from Calcutta, and he hated Calcutta. And shortly, Ward wrote home and said, "Cary has made up his mind to leave all and follow our Savior to Serampore." This is one more little step in his life where it's easy 200 years later to say, well, obviously, I mean, he's going to have his best and happiest years at Serampore. You don't know that when you're going forward. You only know that when you look backwards. But he stepped out once again on faith. And he and his family arrived in Serampore on January 10th, 1800. The community purchased property on the Hooghly River. It ended up being a perfect spot. They were able to get a good deal from the Danish government. In fact, the governor actually walked them down to the property and said, "We think this would be a good place for you. It's already got some great buildings." They purchased that. They set up a printing press almost immediately. In fact, Ward had brought one with him from England. And Ward was a skillful printer. I won't be able to talk a lot about Cary's associates, but let me tell you that Ward is going to build this printing establishment into the largest printing press in all of Asia by 1820. They're going to be putting out millions of sheets of paper on an annual basis. It's going to be an astonishing operation. But Ward was also a great preacher. I like to tell the story of Adoniram and Ann Judson. You've probably heard of them. Well, when the Judsons arrived in India in 1813, they had converted to Baptist views on their way over, and they traveled up to Serampore and said, "Hey, could you British Baptists help us out?" And Ward is the one who baptized Adoniram and Ann Judson. And then Marshman turns out to be an expert educator. Joshua Marshman had worked in education in England. He brought educational know-how with him. And he and his wife, Hannah, started establishing schools. It turned out the East India Company liked schools. So while you couldn't overtly preach in outside Serampore, they allowed them to start various schools, schools for women, schools for poor children, schools to teach English as a second language, all these schools. And schools spread all over Northeast India, and Marshman ended up being a genius for that. But doesn't mean it was easy. Within weeks, William Grant and Daniel Brunston both got cholera and died. That is, this is still a hard place to go. Their wives took their families and returned to England. Miss Tidd stuck around, the one who was going to marry John Fountain, and 4 years after arriving, instead, she married Mr. Ward, William Ward. Ward, Cary, there's Cary, there's Ward, there's Marshman. They became known as the Serampore Trio. This is going to be one of the great partnerships. I mean, that's a small pyramid, right? But it's a great partnership. And they are going to work together for the next 23 years. And there's probably never been a missionary partnership that worked better than this one. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about the community they built here in Serampore. Tonight is going to be less rigorously chronological than last night. Last night we kind of worked our way from 1761 to 1799. I like telling stories that way. If I tried to do that from 1800 to 1834, it would be 10 o'clock, brother. So we're going to have to approach it a little differently. This will be more like Sunday night, where we kind of hit areas of their lives and talk about them. But let me begin by just telling you how this community worked. It was a model community. Right away, these missionaries looked at Kerry and said, "You're the leader." He was 39 years old. He was still a young man, but they were all quite a bit younger. And he became the recognized leader. And he set about establishing a community that would be a model. Everything they had, they held in common. You say, well, that sounds like communism. Well, actually, it sounds like Acts 2, because no government was enforcing this. These were just believers who loved each other and said that no matter when we start selling books, if the proceeds come in, they belong to the community. Right? Wherever the money comes from, it belongs to the community. Most of their proceeds they put into mission funds. That is, these missionaries did not live high on the hog. They tried to live at about the level of the people they were evangelizing. They held devotions twice a day. They held all their meals in common. And when they had preaching services, they rotated it among the three men, all of whom were excellent preachers. On Saturday nights, they would hold weekly conferences. This was wisdom on their part. This is Kerry's idea. He said, every Saturday night, I want the whole community to sit down, children and all, and if you've got a problem, let's talk about it. Air your grievances. Let's not have any backbiting. Let's not have any gossiping. Let's not have any let's not have bitterness forming. Let's just talk. Then on Thursday nights, they held what were called experience meetings, in which they didn't have a formal sermon. They just got together and said, "What's the Lord done in your life since last Thursday?" And everybody could speak. And so the wives and the children and the pastors would say, "Well, the Lord has impressed this passage in Romans in my heart." And you can see how the way this is organized, it's going to create a spiritual community. They had three watchwords for their community: honesty, intimacy, equality. Honesty, intimacy, equality. But as I mentioned, Kerry had problems in his own household. From the beginning, most people recognize that he's running Serampore better than he's running his house. That is, he's not got any help from his wife, who he has to care for despite her madness, and he's got boys that are just running wild. And once again, the Lord provided. Hannah Marshman became the community mom. She was a great missionary in her own right, started numerous schools, but in particular, she reined in Felix, she reined in William. She said, "Young men, you're going to do right from now on." And she helped them learn what that meant. Both of those men are going to be missionaries later. Now, Felix is a sad story. He goes off the rails later, but not until he's been to Burma as a missionary. William was a faithful missionary all his life. She started schools for Hindu women. By 1826, there were 14 of these schools that she was overseeing. Meanwhile, the men went on preaching excursions on a regular basis. That is, virtually every day, they would spend at least some time in the marketplace preaching. Ward and Marshman, within a year of arriving in Calcutta, were preaching in Bengali. Kerry had worked on the language. He was fluent in it by this time, but he was amazed himself by how quickly these men picked it up. They were both excellent scholars. They worked hard at it. Ward is later going to write A History and Culture of India, which is going to be one of the most notable explanations of Hindu culture that's ever been written. They face constant opposition. We read of them being pelted by rocks and eggs and parts of dead animals and being jeered at and being physically assaulted. And the British East India Company said it was not interested in protecting them. And in Serampore, they were safe. And they evangelized Serampore, but they would cross the river and get by with whatever they could get by with. They printed up copies of Matthew and distributed them. And they did this for weeks and saw no Hindu converts. Kerry wrote, "I have no doubt, but in the end, the God of all grace will exert his almighty power and establish the glory of his own name in this country." Portugal, France, Spain. "He will exert his almighty power. Our labors may be only like those of pioneers to prepare the way, but truth will assuredly prevail. And this, among other kingdoms of the earth, shall assuredly see the salvation of our God." Well, in October of 1800, 10 months after Carrie moved there, Thomas showed up. Thomas had led a vagabond life for the last several years. He was a wreck, but he heard about the Serampore community and decided he would drop in. They probably greeted him with mixed feelings, but they accepted him warmly. And just then, a Hindu laborer by the name of Krishna Powell fell and injured his shoulder and needed a doctor. And they called for Dr. Thomas. And Dr. Thomas treated his shoulder and shared the gospel with him. And Krishna was interested. And he began attending Serampore community meetings. And he heard Carrie preach. And he heard Ward preach. And he had conversations with them. And he asked them questions. And in less than 2 months, he got saved. The first Hindu that they had seen saved. And is it not remarkable that he was led to the Lord by John Thomas? I mean, Carrie must have wondered about that. By the way, Thomas by this time was pretty unstable. Weeks after Krishna Powell was saved, he went insane and had to be restrained, and he was dead early in 1801. Less than 6 months after winning Krishna Powell. It's like the Lord said, I've got one last thing for you to do, Thomas. Go to Serampore, win the first Hindu to Christ, and then I'm going to take you home. Carrie baptized Krishna on December 28, 1800. Krishna Powell paid a price almost immediately. He had a daughter who was engaged to be married to a Hindu man. When that family found out that Powell had gone over to the dark side, they abducted Krishna Powell's daughter and forced her to marry their son. And then you read that a few years later, both husband and wife got saved and joined the church that Krishna Powell was attending, which was a gospel-preaching church. Now, God doesn't always do that sort of thing, but don't these stories tell us he can? In addition, of course, to the scriptures, our authority. Let me quote for you William Ward's report back to England of the baptismal service. I told my wife, too many quotes tonight, but they're all really good. So bear with my reading to you a little bit. Ward wrote home and said, after our English service at which I preached on baptism, we went to the riverside, immediately opposite our gate, when the governor, a number of Europeans and Portuguese, and many Hindus and Mohammedans attended. That's baptism should be public declarations, right? We sang in Bengali, Jesus and Shall It Ever Be. Carrie then spoke in Bengali, particularly declaring that we did not think the water sacred. Hindus have sacred rivers that they bathe in for sacred purposes. But water only. And that the one from amongst them about to be baptized professed by this act to put off all sins and to put on Christ. After prayer, he went down the bank into the water, taking Felix in his right hand and baptized him. So his son Felix, who had been a rebel until just recently, accepted baptism at his dad's hand. Then Krishna went down and was baptized, the words in Bengali. All was silence. The governor could not restrain his tears. And almost everyone seemed struck with the solemnity of this new ordinance. I never saw in the most orderly congregation in England anything more impressive. And then Ward says, ye gods of stone and clay, did ye not tremble when in the triune name one soul shook you from his feet as dust? Glory. He was not going to be the last Hindu to get saved at Serampore or through their influence. I'm not going to give you stats. Because, in fact, Serampore has been criticized for not winning more Hindus to Christ. But by the time Carrie died, there had been several thousand who had come to Christ, and the seeds were spreading far and wide. In fact, I got to tell you something that's not in the notes. One of Carrie's translations is going to be carried far away into a northern Indian village in the Himalayas, and It's going to be carried by an Indian up there who's going to leave it, and there's going to be no missionary work by any Westerners. And the people there, that Bible's going to be there for about 20 years. And when the Western missionaries finally make their way into that part of India, which is one of the last to be penetrated, they're going to find a village in which almost everyone is saved. And they're going to go around saying, how did you find out about Christ? And they're going to take them to a box and say, through this book, and they're open it, it's going to be one of Carrie's translations. That's how God was doing things that that humans couldn't account for. Sarampore set up a purpose statement, 11 statements of purpose. Let me quickly share these, but I think they show what they were about. Number one, to set an infinite value on men's souls. Number two, to acquaint ourselves with the snares which hold the minds of the people. Number three, to abstain from whatever deepens India's prejudice against the gospel. They knew there were many prejudices, most of which were brought by the British settlers. We're not going to do that here. Number four, to watch for every chance of doing the people good. Maybe sometimes we can't share the gospel. Maybe sometimes all we can do is set a broken bone. We're still going to do that. Number five, to preach Christ crucified as the grand means of conversions. To esteem and treat Indians always as our equals. To guard and build up the hosts that may be gathered. That's discipleship. To cultivate their spiritual gifts, ever pressing upon them their missionary obligation, since Indians only can win India for Christ. To labor unceasingly in biblical translation, more about that shortly. To be instant in the nurture of personal religion. Let's not go so busy ministering to others, we forget to cultivate our own walk with Christ. And finally, to give ourselves without reserve to the cause, not counting even the clothes we wear our own. That was what Sarampore was about. Let me briefly break away from the story and tell you how the Lord began to use this almost immediately. I'll call this second inspiration. I wish I could spend a lot longer here. A couple of quick slides. John Ryland Jr. got together with a group of Congregationalist pastors. Congregationalists are very much like Baptists in their theology, except that they baptize babies, which of course is a significant problem, but it was covenant baptism, not baptism regeneration. And Ryland read Carey's letters to them, and those Congregationalists said, we've got to get involved in that. This is in the early 1790s. And in 1795, they came together to form the London Missionary Society. A year later, they sent 30 missionaries to Tahiti, and they're going to send hundreds of missionaries out over the next 100 years. Charles Simeon, one of the great conservative evangelical Anglicans, read Carey's letters and said, why are we Anglicans not doing this? Why are we not having a part? Now, there were Anglicans who didn't believe the gospel, but there were evangelical Anglicans like John Newton and William Wilberforce who said, Brother Simeon, if you think we can do this, we're going to do this. And they established in 1799 the Church Missionary Society. The Church Missionary Society is going to send out far more missionaries than the BMS because it was a huge organization. Hundreds and thousands of missionaries. Within 25 years, the English Methodists said, if Carey can do it, we can do it. We're not going to let these Calvinists outstrip us. The English General Baptist, Dan Taylor's group, said, hey, we're going to send out missionaries if those Calvinists are doing it. The American Congregationalists, that's the group that Judson was a part of. And then the American Baptists were directly influenced by Carey. That is one denomination after another and more than I've listed here. J.G. Greenhow said, the light which Carey had kindled spread from hill to hill like beacon fires, till every Christian church in turn recognized the signal and responded to the call. Pastor said it two or three times. Nobody could have seen this coming when a little group of poor upcountry pastors started getting a burden in 1785. But God was at work. There had been many missionaries before Carey, but this explosion gave him the title the father of modern missions. But now let's go back to our story. For the rest of the ministry, I'm going to have to cover Carey's life in sections. And I'm going to cover it in four sections. His work as a translator, his work as a professor, his work as a reformer, and his life as a husband and father. So mature ministry, 30 years. First of all, his work as a translator. That's what he's famous for, right? Timothy George, biographer, called him the William Tyndale of India. He learned Bengali, the primary language in that part of India. India is a country of many, many, many languages. But Bengali was the one spoken in Calcutta and the surrounding area. He worked on it while he was on the boat going over. By 1796, he had translated the New Testament. Please put this in the context of last night. Remember what all was going on in his life last night? Well, while he was going through all that, he was translating the whole New Testament into Bengali. During his lifetime, he came out with 8 new editions, each one improved. He completed the Old Testament, a much larger task, between 1802 and 1809, putting out 5 new editions. In 1801, William Ward printed the first Bengali New Testament. He then went on to produce a Bengali grammar and a dictionary. There is a page of the Bengali New Testament, and if you can read that, then you're Indian. But he didn't limit himself to Bengali. He also decided that the Bible needed to be in Sanskrit. Now, Sanskrit was the sacred language of India. People didn't speak Sanskrit. It was essentially dead. So why put the Bible in it? Well, because all of the upper classes of India read it. It was their sacred scriptures. The Vedas and the Upanishads were all in Sanskrit. And so he decided to translate the Bible into Sanskrit, and he did. He decided to produce a Sanskrit grammar. There was no Sanskrit grammar, remarkably. He produced a Sanskrit dictionary. And then he did something that was highly controversial. I don't even know if you'll agree with this. But he said, the problem is millions of Indians can't read their own Bible. They can't read their own Bible. That is, they can't read Sanskrit. They speak Bengali or Uriya or one of the other dialects, and they can't read Sanskrit. But we're never going to win into Christ until they can read the Bible, and they won't read the Bible until they can read, and they don't want to read because they can't read their scriptures. So he decided to translate the Hindu sacred scriptures from Sanskrit into Bengali. He took the Vedas, the Upanishads, and made them available in the language of the people. And he was criticized by many missionaries. He said, listen, once they can read, and they read their scriptures, and they read the truth, we'll have them. He desired literacy. There's Sanskrit. It may look similar to Bengali, but Sanskrit and Bengali are about as different as, say, German and Italian. I mean, these are very different languages. Quote, this is quoting Timothy George, by 1837, the year of Marshman's death, Carey and his associates had translated the Bible into some 40 languages and dialects. Carey himself was responsible, personally, for translating the entire Bible into Bengali, Uriya, Marathi, Hinki, Assamese, and Sanskrit, as well as portions into 29 other languages. One of his biographers said that Carey became such a linguist that they would run passages in front of him of languages he himself had not personally studied, and he could spot grammar errors because he understood linguistics so well and say, you know, I'm not sure, but I doubt that is a correct construction. He'd send it back and they'd discover they'd made a mistake. He was just genius. They suffered through a terrible calamity. I won't spend long on this, but a fire hit the printing house in 1812. This is probably the biggest trial they went through during these 30 years. It destroyed a massive collection of manuscripts, translations, dictionaries, grammars, destroyed his dictionary of Sanskrit and its Indian cognates, over 1,500 reams of paper destroyed, 4,400 pounds of English type. It was a disaster. How did Carey respond? Well, how do you think Carey responded? I wish to be still and know that the Lord is God, and to bow to his divine will in everything. He will no doubt bring good out of this evil, and make it the occasion of promoting his interest. To us at present, the providence is exceeding dark. That is, it's a hard time. But is God on the throne? So number one, he was a translator. Now let me just say that his translations were not always of the highest quality. That is, Adoniram Judson is going to spend 20 years translating the Bible into Burmese, and that translation is still used in Burma today. Carey and his group, their idea was get the Bible into as many hands as possible, and they did. They translated into Persian, into Chinese, they had their own Burmese translation. They translated into hundreds of languages. None of those Bibles were in use by 1900 because later missionaries came in and said, you know, we're thankful for this translation, but it's a little hasty. Let's improve upon it. And they replaced them all. But that was the calling Carey had. Secondly, he was a professor. Serampore used education to reach Indians. Native schools, boarding schools, girls' schools, Sunday schools. By 1817, they had 103 schools, which had an average total population of over 1,600 students that they were influencing with the gospel. That is, they taught them English, they taught them culture, they taught them their own scriptures, and they taught them theology. But Carey himself became a professor. Fort William College was established in Calcutta in 1802, and they contacted Carey and said, "We need a professor of Bengali here. You think you could do it?" You suppose he was intimidated? He had never in his life attended a college class, even to listen. He'd never sat in one. I mean, he was a weaver's son. And they wanted him to be Professor Carey. Furthermore, what they were asking was not going to be easy. He accepted the job. That involved every time he went to the school, he had to row 16 miles down the Hooghly River to get there. So he taught Tuesday through Thursday. He donated his 1,500-pound salary to the mission. That is, they paid him really well, but he gave it all away. He's going to be Professor Carey for the next 29 years. And in 1807, Brown University is going to make him Dr. Carey. Who'd have figured? Who saw that coming? And here, I've got to share with you what his life looked like. Plotting genius. All right, here's the genius part. He wrote a letter to Andrew Fuller in 1806. Here it goes. Here's a typical day. "I rose this day at 6:15, read a chapter in the Hebrew Bible, and spent the time till 7 in private addresses to God, and then attended family prayer with the servants in Bengali. While tea was pouring out, I read a little in Persian with a munshi, who was waiting when I left my bedroom. Read also before breakfast a portion of the scriptures in Hindustani. The moment breakfast was over, I sat down to the translation of the Ramayana from Sanskrit with a pundit. Continued this translation till 10 o'clock, at which time I went to college and attended the duties there till between 1 and 2. When I returned home, I examined a proof sheet of the Bengali translation of Jeremiah, which took till dinner time. After dinner, translated with the assistance of the chief pundit of the college, greatest part of the 8th chapter of Matthew into Sanskrit. This employed me till 6 o'clock. After 6, sat down with the Tlinga pundit to learn that language. Mr. Thomas called in the evening. I began to collect a few..." This is not John Thomas. This is a different Mr. Thomas. "I began to collect a few previous thoughts into the form of a sermon at 7 o'clock and preached in English at 7:30. The congregation was gone by 9 o'clock. I then sat down to write to you. After this, I conclude the evening by reading a chapter in the Greek Testament and committing myself to God. I have never more time in a day than this, though the exercises vary." If you were counting, he worked in 8 languages that day. And just reading that makes me tired. And that was a day in the life of William Carey. They believed in education. In 1818, they started Serampore College. 37 students initially, half internationals, half Hindus. But by 1821, it was a thriving place, and they built this. All right, that is, it became a beautiful school that was a major education center well after they were gone. So number one, translation. Number two, education. But you know what? They didn't ignore all the problems in Hindu India. They opposed slavery. Way back before Carey ever sailed to India, he had said, "I am so opposed to the slavery in the West Indies that I'm not eating any more of their sugar." He rejoiced when the slave trade was finally abolished through William Wilberforce's efforts. And in 1833, when slavery throughout the British Empire ended, they set aside a month of Thanksgiving for it. He hated slavery. Why? Because he believed that they were eternal souls. They were equals before God. He also opposed a very common practice in India of infant exposure. The Hindus would take unwanted babies, usually girls, and they would put them in a basket and hang it in a tree and just leave it for the animals to eat. And the missionaries couldn't rescue all the babies. They rescued a lot of them. They started orphanages. But they went to the British government and said, "This is immoral. You've got to stop this." And the British government said, "It's none of our business." And Carey agitated for change for years until finally a law was passed against it. He also preached constantly against abortion, which was very common in India. They opposed euthanasia. You say, euthanasia? The Hindus believe in a cyclical life. That you live, you die, you come back, you live again, you die, you come back, you live again, you die. There is no value in life. And when people would get old and infirm, why feed them? They'll be reincarnated anyway. And they would take elderly people down by the river and just leave them to die. And the missionaries went and collected them as much as they could. And they established homes to care for elderly Hindu people. And once again, they agitated for the government to pass a law against it, which the British finally did. By the way, there's another whole story where William Wilberforce is their partner in Parliament. And he would get letters complaining about these things, and he'd go to Parliament and he'd fight for change. The British East India Company lost that battle and finally allowed missionaries into India, but not till about 1820. They opposed sati. This is what he's famous for. Many widows desired to do this. Some, it was against their will, but the tradition was to burn widows on their husband's funeral pyre. In 1799, Carey came upon a sati and witnessed it. He assailed them for it and begged them to save the woman's life, and they railed on him and said, "You Westerners don't know our traditions. Leave us alone." He launched a 29-year effort to a 31-year effort to defeat it. What he did is that he read the Hindu scriptures cover to cover, and then he met with leading Hindu theologians from around India and said, "Show me in your scriptures where sati is." And they had to admit that there was no scriptural basis for it in the Hindu scriptures. And once he got them to admit that, he was able to convince the British government to pass a law against it, finally in 1829. Carey considered that a tremendous victory. In short, they didn't just love the Indian souls, they loved the Indians. And they poured their lives into them. Let me come to the conclusion. Carey was a husband and a dad. His first wife was Dorothy, Dolly. We can't forget that she was faithful to him through some really hard years. She bore him 4 sons and 3 daughters. They loved each other, and then she went insane. Quote, "Her misery and rage is extreme," Carey wrote. "Bless God, all the dirt which she throws is such as cannot stick, but it is the ruin of my children to hear such continual accusations." He was heartsick. But he would not commit her to an asylum. He cared for her for 12 years. Hannah Marshman sort of took care of the kids. And then on December 8th, 1807, just shy of her 52nd birthday, Dolly went home to be with the Lord. There was a missionary there, a Danish lady, named Charlotte. And she had been helping out at the mission. And about 2 months after Dolly died, Carey approached her and said, "Would you possibly be interested in consideration of future matrimonial connections?" The Serampore community was slightly scandalized, but Carey said, "I believe this is right." They did wait till 1808 to get married. She had converted to Baptist views under his teaching from her Danish Lutheranism. She was the opposite of his first wife, Dolly, in many ways. She was fluent in several languages, worked right alongside him in translation. She had tremendous character. The boys took to her immediately. 13 years of very sweet marriage. She died in 1821, and Carey wrote to Ryland and said, "We had been married 13 years and 3 weeks, during all which season I believe we had as great a share of conjugal happiness as ever was enjoyed by mortals." And then God gave him a third wife, Grace Hughes. They married about a year after Charlotte's death. And like Charlotte and Dolly, he baptized her. How many men do you know baptized all 3 of their wives? And she cared for him for the remainder of his life. She outlived him by a few years. Carey's matrimonial life was quite interesting. His kids, I guess I'll talk about them in just a moment. I have to briefly mention controversy. I don't want to sit here. In 1815, Andrew Fuller died. Andrew Fuller had been the anchor in England. Young men took over the Home Office, and within just a couple of years, they were writing arrogant letters to Serampore saying, "The mission there doesn't belong to you, it belongs to us, and we're going to appoint missionaries the way we think is best, and we'll take your suggestions under advisement." And Carey and Marshman and Ward were outraged. Ward traveled to England and battled them for 2 years there. Probably broke his health, because when he returned, he only lived 2 more years and died. It was ridiculous. The controversy went on for almost a decade, and finally, tragically, in 1828, Serampore wrote to the BMS and said, you know, we really don't need you guys. And they severed all connection and were self-sufficient. But it just shows that people are people, even the best of people. Carey's health began to fail. Late 1820s, he was not an old man, but he had lived in a very demanding schedule, as you've seen. He was now in his late 60s. The mission was doing incredibly well. In 1820, the British government said, okay, I guess we'll let missionaries into India. They seem to be doing more good than harm. By the mid-30s, 50 missionaries, 18 mission stations around India. And God did wonderful things in India for a long time. He'd lost Felix in 1822. Felix is another story. Went to Burma as a missionary, got corrupted by materialism, became an alcoholic, died tragically. William Ward died, the youngest of the men, in 1823. Marshman outlived him for a few years, but Carey's health failed in 1834. His three sons who were living were with him. Jabez and William were dynamic missionaries who came home to be with him at the end. They served the remainder of their lives. And Jonathan, for whom Carey had prayed for 30 years, had just recently gotten saved. June 9th, 1834, Carey went home to be with the Lord at the very young age of 72. They asked him before he died, "What should we put on your tombstone?" He loved Isaac Watts' hymns. And they carved on his tombstone, "A wretched, poor, and helpless worm, on thy kind arms I fall." That was Carey. That's close. What do we learn? He was unique. He was a linguist. What am? He was a botanist. He was a genius. I don't know if you fit any of those categories. I don't. Carey was flawed. He was a poor husband, at least with his first wife. We talked about that last night. He was a poor father all the way through. I mean, given the daily schedule we just described, how much time was there for his boys? But Carey was a model. Humble service, diligent service, sacrificial service. Let's close by letting Carey share his own testimony. He wrote to Jabez on his 70th birthday, 1831, and here's what he said. "I am this day 70 years old, a monument of divine mercy and goodness. Though on a review of my life, I find much, very much, for which I ought to be humbled in the dust. My direct and positive sins are innumerable. My negligence in the Lord's work has been great. I have not promoted his cause nor sought his glory and honor as I ought. Notwithstanding all this, I am spared till now and am still retained in his work. And I trust I am received into the divine favor through him. I wish to be more entirely devoted to his service." This is a 70-year-old man. Amen, Frenchie? "I wish to be more entirely devoted to his service, more completely sanctified, and more habitually exercising all the Christian graces, and bringing forth the fruits of righteousness to the praise and honor of that Savior who gave his life a sacrifice for sin." That was his testimony. He was a genius, but the reason we're talking about him today and yesterday is because he was a faithful plotter whom God chose to grace. And God will do that for us too. Amen? Pastor.